For 35 years, the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation has been dedicated to saving thoroughbred racehorses no longer able to compete on the racetrack from possible neglect, abuse, and slaughter. The oldest and largest charity in the U.S. devoted to racehorses, the TRF makes a promise of lifelong sanctuary to those horses unable to pursue a second athletic career. Unique within the aftercare industry, the horses of the TRF find their second chance in the role of teachers through the TRF Second Chances program, which provides vocational training in 7 correctional facilities across the U.S. The program is Saving Horses and Saving Lives. Learn more at www.trfinc.org, and please use the special In the Money podcast link to donate, trfinc.org/players. You're listening to the In the Money Players Podcast. Hello and welcome to the In the Money Players Podcast. This is show number 80. It is Monday, October 30th. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornital, back with you in the Brooklyn Bunker once again for my favorite type of show. And all I mean by that is there are some weekends where my co-host and I are in constant communication, and we've sort of done like a mini version of the show before we ever get on the air, which just isn't as interesting. Sometimes it's probably better for the content because we sort of know what conversations are going somewhere and which aren't. But this time, it's as if he's been on lockdown and I've been on lockdown. We haven't spoken one bit, so I'm very happy now to bring in the co-host of this program, the chief creative officer of In the Money Media, but you probably know him better as the People's Champion from the planet Texas. Jonathan Kinchin, what's up?
PTF, what is the word?
The word is good.
That's good. That's good. I missed you this weekend.
I missed you too, buddy. There was a lot going on in the world of racing and a lot going on in our lives as well.
It's one of the last kind of prep weekends. We get one more next weekend where we can kind of get excited about the Breeders' Cup. Some disappointments this weekend, obviously, I'm sure we'll get to, and some opportunities I'm sure we'll all be looking forward to come the first Friday and Saturday in November.
There wasn't a lot in terms of winners given out. I was happy. At least Mirth won. That helped my ego a little bit. But I feel like I was very wrong about a lot of very big horses. And let's start there. Actually, you know what? I'll make you pick. Of the big races of the weekend, which one do you want to start with?
I'd say let's go to California, and then the decision then has to be, do we want to talk about 8 Rings and the American Pharaoh, or McKenzie and Mongolian Groom? I'll narrow it to those two. I'll let you pick.
I think we got to start with Mongolian Groom, 110 buyer speed figure in victory, wires the field out there in the awesome again. Shocking result, 25-1. These are win and you're in races, but they it would be awkward to stipulate in the title win and you're in unless you didn't get yourself nominated. So now big decisions have to be made by the connections of Mongolian Groom. Do they put up the $200,000 to compete in the Breeders' Cup? Mongolian Groom gets the job done. McKenzie, a disappointing second. I can't really say there was any particular excuse. You have been the biggest fan of this horse. I saw you chirping at people and Twitter about it. What's your perspective on what we saw out there in California?
Yeah, I watched the race again this morning just to kind of let it marinate. My first thought was one of those situations that I think we've all kind of become a little bit more familiar with, which is where these oddly run races in terms of pace can kind of give you these weird results that can be shocking. Guarana, when she ran in the Coaching Club American Oaks, her performance wasn't nearly as impressive as I think people had expected. I think it had more to do with kind of the slow-paced nature of that race. So the excuse that I came up with, and I'll be honest, it's not a strong excuse. What happened with McKenzie was it just wasn't a really fast race. He was out there kind of hung out to the outside. I think if Mike could have it back, he would have just put the horse on the front end and no one would have ran by him. But instead, as it being a prep and it not being exactly the goal, you know, getting ready for a 1.25-mile race coming up in about 5 weeks, I think he just wanted to sit to the outside. And a tricky thing with McKenzie is you can't hit him. If you notice when they hit him with the whip, he hit him with the whip one time because I think he had an oh crap moment there where Mongolian Groom looked like he was going to get away, and McKenzie switched his tail and didn't really level off the way that I think Mike wanted to. So I think they probably learned a lesson there. I'd imagine we'd see him on the front end come Breeders' Cup Classic time.
That's an interesting read. I don't think this was a particularly slow pace, though. We don't have time form U.S. pace figures yet. But, I mean, just looking at the raw fractions, 23 and 4, 48 and 1, 112 for 6. I mean, it wasn't fast, but it seems like it was just honest. So while I take your point tactically, I think you have to acknowledge the fact that McKenzie just wasn't very good on Saturday.
I wouldn't want to punch you in the face for that argument, but I do disagree about the pace. I mean, you know, those are 12s on a racetrack that usually plays quicker than that. Obviously, the track might be a little bit deeper considering the circumstances.
Yeah.
But then if you look at what, you know, at Saratoga, he went 23 and 3, 47 and 2, 111 and 2 at Saratoga going a mile and an eighth. So I would say that's significantly quicker fractions, almost a whole second faster at every call. And so on a racetrack that's equally as deep, I think. You know,
I put that down to different racing surfaces. This is a pointless conversation until we have pace figures. There's no sense comparing raw fractions at tracks the entire country away. So why don't we just put a pin in that part of the discussion and revisit it when we have some pace figures as we do this on Monday morning. We don't yet have the time form numbers, and I haven't spoken to any of our other figure-making friends. Believe me, I'm not saying it was fast. I'm just saying it wasn't like some comical strangle fest all the way around there. It just looked odd, and you know, we'll see. There's more information that we're going to have about that, but it sounds like we do have a little bit of a fundamental disagreement. Hey, and listen, just because McKenzie wasn't, in my view, particularly good on that day doesn't mean I don't think he can rebound. It is just a little weird when they come into it reportedly working so well in the tar. Everything seemed like it should have been go, so it's strange to me to see that result. Could there have been some track bias involved in your view, JK? You noted the position of both the winner and McKenzie throughout the race. Could that have contributed to the result potentially?
I'm not sure if there's necessarily like a, you know, inside-outside bias, but when you talk about the track, I will say this, you know, since December 26th, McKenzie hasn't won at Santa Anita. He's run three times at Santa Anita and hasn't won. There's a possibility that he's not a fan of whatever this surface has kind of become, you know, since December 26th, right? I would imagine the racetrack he's running on now, not even considering the climate differences between, you know, now and December, but the surface he's running on now, I think, is probably significantly different than the one he ran on when he won the Malibu. And for whatever reason, he doesn't seem to like it. And unfortunately, the Breeders' Cup Classic will be run on that same surface.
But it doesn't give you any pause. You were still out there looking for head-to-head wagers, McKenzie versus any horse. So when we redo these rankings tomorrow, I think I still am going to have McKenzie number one all in all. As much as things got shaken up over the weekend, I don't know that I want to put Vino Rosso or Code of Honor ahead of him now. I think it's still McKenzie on top for me, just with like a little bit more trepidation. How do you feel about that?
I think the Code of Honor might deserve it, right? I mean, he obviously will transition to that race as well, but I think he probably crowned himself as the three-year-old champ. So I would imagine that he'll get a lot of votes, winning the Jockey Club Gold Cup against Older, having the Travers under his belt. I wouldn't be surprised if he ended up being first after McKenzie kind of had fallen to such a suspect foe in Mongolian Groom. So you know, but I would imagine disqualification is going to be involved in people's decision making as well.
We'll get to that in a minute. Let's keep it here for a sec and talk about some of these other runners to come out of the awesome again. Let's start with Mongolian Groom. You are hired as a bloodstock advisor to the Connections. Do you recommend spending the 200 or do you pick a different course of action?
If I was him, I would point to the December race, get the Japanese excited that you're going to run there, get them interested. And then I would call up the Breeders' Cup and say, look, I'm going to run in Japan after this. I've announced it. I'm going to do a bunch of media in Japan talking about it. And I'm going to tell them that I'm prepping over here in the Breeders' Cup Classic. So you're going to get a lot of Japanese eyes and international eyes involved. Are you sure it's 200,000?
JK giving
honest,
us a little
that's
glimpse.
That's the honest answer of exactly what I would do.
Giving a little glimpse of how the sausage is made. Try to get somebody else to pay the $200. I think I know what the answer would be in that instance, and it involves fists and sand. Let's just put it that way. Other horses who ran in the race, who we've been talking about as part of our top 10 for this classic division, Higher Power and Seeking the Soul. What did you see from either of them to potentially affect your view of them going forward?
Higher Power stumbled at the start. Frank Miramati called that out. So obviously that had some influence in the situation of how he ran. You know, I guess he's one that you'd want to consider going the mile and a quarter. He ran so well in the Pacific Classic. Seeking the Soul is the other reason I don't think the pace was that fast. If you look at Seeking the Soul's past performances, when was the last time Seeking the Soul was so close to the pace? I mean, he was up there. And so that was kind of one of the reasons why I felt like and he was up there going on a mile and an eighth race as well. So that's one of the reasons why I felt like the pace wasn't exactly swift, because he found himself pretty close. He was two lengths out of it first call. So I think that he's one that maybe at a mile and a quarter is probably his best distance. And I think that he could probably get back involved and hit the board at a mile and a quarter. But I don't want him to win based on this performance.
To clarify, I never said the pace was fast. I said it wasn't comically slow. Huge difference between those two ideas. But I take your point about Seeking the Soul being that close to the early pace. And I also take the point about it being more of a true prep for Seeking the Soul and him wanting every inch of the mile and a quarter. For me, I think Higher Power and Seeking the Soul both end up being they're going to be ranked in that top 10 somewhere in the middle, but I'm just not that excited, obviously, about either of them for this test. It's hard to know. I mean, it's the race suddenly has a lot more of an open look, and it does make you wonder if you were the bricks and mortar connections, for example. And it does sound like, as you and I both suspected they might, that they're looking to the mile mostly at the moment for bricks and mortar. I think the idea being that a swiftly run mile could bring a little bit more of his stamina. This is a horse we think is going to be best at 10 furlongs into play. I still have no reason other than trusting Chad Brown and where he spotted the horse to think that bricks and mortar doesn't want the 12 furlongs. But do the results of these races this weekend make you think a little bit, if you were the bricks and mortar crew, about trying to do something a little crazy and taking the classic? Sure doesn't seem like a Chad Brown move.
Doesn't seem like a Chad Brown move. You know, it's one of those deals where, to really answer the question, I got to know what the paperwork for the Stallion deal says, really. I mean,
right.
That's if there's a kicker in there for him to win the grade one on the dirt. What is it? It does it exist? Is it even there? Because if it's not there, is it really worth it? Is it really going to change? I guess it would change his value as a Stallion if he could pull off the grade one classic on the dirt at a mile and a quarter, make him a pretty attractive Stallion prospect. But I don't foresee that being a decision that they make. That's not something that Chad really does. And Seth Klarman's not the type of owner who's going to get involved and start pushing buttons and moving things. He's not an owner pick the spot guy.
Yeah.
It feels like bricks and mortar running in the classic would be an owner pick the spot move. I don't see him doing that.
That's all very fair. And you have to remember another factor why they might prefer just sticking with the turf is the idea of just how much Horse of the Year is in play right now, right? And he'd have to be a leading contender with a win at the breeder, with a win in any Breeders' Cup race. Isn't he going to look very good for that honor? I don't know if there could be a kicker in the stud deal for that, but I mean, there's obviously got to be some sort of emotional value in winning Horse of the Year for the ownership group and for Chad Brown.
I would think right now he's Horse of the Year, right?
I mean, right. If you just made us vote and you said, okay, the rest of the year is canceled, we're going to vote on Horse of the Year right now. He's certainly, I mean, I guess there, who would the other contenders be, thinking about it?
Right now, I think the three finalists would be him, Midnight Bisou, and Code of Honor, right?
Yeah, I mean, between those three, I got to go bricks and mortar, yeah. And Midnight Bisou would probably be my second. You really want to talk about Code of Honor. I can tell you've brought him up a couple of times. I think we go right. We'll loop back to more chat about California. But I think while we're talking about this division, it only makes sense to go to the Jockey Club Gold Cup. I'm so excited because I have no idea what you're going to say about this disqualification, JK. I'll start with my opinion. Look, I didn't in the pan, I didn't think anything was going to happen. Watching the head-on, that first bump, I mean, I have not watched this to like Maximum Security Derby level stuff, okay? So I reserve the right to look at this another way. But I thought that first foul was more than the garden variety hurting that usually gets left alone. I thought there was contact. I thought Code of Honor was like briefly knocked off stride. I didn't really think that the other two bumps mattered all that much. But this is where I feel like you have to consider the result at the end of the race. So when you're talking about a nose and you have an incident like that, that I thought was not two horses going at each other the way you can describe some of these DQs we've seen, but I thought was clearly instigated by the party that ended up crossing the line first, zero problem with the DQ, and honestly shocked that so many sharp people seem to hate it so much. Where do you stand on this?
Unfortunately, I think a lot of sharp people found Vino Rosso to be the value of the race. I think a lot of sharp people might have been backing Vino Rosso, so that obviously influences the decision.
Fair.
Look, if you treat this like a race on a Wednesday, I think that would kind of change the way you look at it. I thought he should have came down. I thought he bumped the horse. I thought the margin of victory at the end mattered. I'm not sure that it's supposed to matter, but I think it did matter. I think that if Vino Rosso would have pulled away late and won by half a length, they wouldn't have taken Code of Honor down. But since Code of Honor lost by a nasty nose, I think they can then say that that little bump, significant or not, wasn't enough of a bump to make a difference in the outcome and a cost Code of Honor a placing, if you want to go to those convoluted, wonky rules and how they're written. So, I had no problem with it. Yeah, it was one of those situations where watching it, the head on the first time, I said, he's coming down.
Yep.
And it took a long time to look at it, and that was a decision that was made.
And what were you saying about the race on a Wednesday? You're saying that people would agree with us more if it was just a regular race, or are you saying the opposite? I didn't quite follow that.
I just think if you look at it like through the lens of a Wednesday, it becomes a little bit it allows you to be slightly more objective.
I see.
If you take the fact that it's Todd, you take the fact that it's Suge, you take the fact that it's a win and you're in, you take the fact that it's going to propel Code of Honor to 3-year-old champion, you take all of those things out of the mix, and it's easier to look at it objectively where he should have came down.
I think that's quite debatable about the 3-year-old champion, and we'll get back to that.
Really?
Yeah, I still think you're going to have a lot of Maximum Security fans out there, but I don't want to talk about that.
Stop it.
two grade ones and cross the wire first in the Derby versus, but you think the win against Older is worth that much? Anyway, let's. I don't want to talk about
hold
that.
Hold on, time out. You've been in this game long enough to know that the Blue Bloods and the people that contain the rights to vote for that for that award are not voting for Jason Service over Suge McGahee.
It's just not going to happen. That's very funny. And you may well be right. And look, I'm not saying I'm not going to vote for Code of Honor. I just didn't think it was so cut and dried. I think there's a lot of people out there, and I like how you're just passively aggressively producing the show today as we're going and making me talk about all these things in a different order, which is good. I mean, I let you choose the first race we talk about. I gave you an inch. You've clearly now taken a mile, but that's good with me. The thing that I just wasn't sure about how much emotional value crossing the line first, being clearly the best horse in the Kentucky Derby, was going to have on that. And I was just thinking, objectively, to me, that would give me a lot of pause. I mean, hey, I think I am. Am I going to get to vote for this year? I don't know if I still am, actually. I
can look into that for you, Pete.
Yeah, let's see if we can figure out. I don't know. I mean, believe me, I don't know that I want to. It was always very stressful. I took it too seriously, and it would take too many hours during Christmas week or whenever it was we'd have to do it. So I'm good either way. But for me, I gotta look at everything, and we gotta figure out. I mean, have we heard definitively? Was that Code of Honor's last race of the season?
No, he shook him hard a little bit. Well, I'm gonna talk to Mr. Ferris and see what
he's always gonna say. He said that about the Pennsylvania Derby, a race that there was a 0% chance he was ever going to run. And he's too politic for that. So we'll wait for that story.
It's just shocking that if he doesn't show up, he's the second choice, if not possibly.
He could be the favorite.
Possibly the favorite.
Yeah, he could be the favorite with a buzzy workout. If he works going into the Breeders' Cup this year the way he worked going into it last year, after what we saw from McKenzie, he's probably the favorite. But, you know, you got to do these guys. I mean, Shug McGahee, he knows his horses so well. I mean, I would trust him implicitly. I mean, I figure if he goes there, I think it's all systems go. And if he doesn't go there, I'm not going to sit back here and say, oh, why not take a chance? I'm going to say this is a guy who knows his horses. This is a guy who did an unbelievable job all season by this horse. And I'm going to trust him either way. But boy, assuming no more starts from either, that's going to be it's going to be a fun debate. I take your point. But I mean, the Eclipse votership, there's plenty of everyone at the DRF, for example, who's ever left, gets a vote. I mean, are those people aren't going to care about
they will. But also, the other thing is just put that aside is out of sight, out of mind, right? Like, he hasn't, like, we haven't seen Maximum Security since the summer, and we've seen Code of Honor win two grade ones, two of the most prestigious grade ones since Maximum Security's last race. We probably won't see Maximum Security again this year. I mean, I'm guessing, you know, so. I think it's a foregone conclusion.
It's funny though. Would the timing work for him to run in a race like the Malibu, which would technically count for this year's Eclipse voting? What about that?
Yeah, it always
idea?
Counts. The problem is you can send them in before that. I think you get your ballot before the Malibu's run, and not everyone waits for it.
Right, but what about your fictional ballot, JK? If right now, what would you vote for?
And Code of Honor.
You would vote for Code of Honor right now. And give me the case why. I mean, I see two prestigious grade ones versus two prestigious grade ones and the emotional value of crossing first in the Derby. I don't know. I'm not. I obviously never a Max Security fan, massive Code of Honor fan. So I'm just trying to be objective here. I want to vote for Code of Honor, but I'm not sure. Sometimes when it's happened to me before with the Eclipse ballot where I sit down and I look at it and I'm going to vote one way and then I just blink and do something that surprises me. It wouldn't shock me if this decision came down to something like that for me. What's your intellectual case why Code of Honor's grade ones are worth more? I understand why you're saying you think it's going to happen. You made a great case about that. But why would you vote that way?
So if you just compare the two, I think you would compare the Haskell to the Travers. The Travers is probably the 1A and the Haskell is the 1B. Right? Like, I don't think that, like...
I mean, some would disagree. Bob Baffert would probably disagree, but I get it.
From a standpoint of if the Derby is our biggest race and it's running a mile and a quarter, I think the fact that the Travers is running a mile and a quarter is why it gets that just that little extra oomph at, you know, across the wire and a nasty photo with the Haskell. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think the Haskell's a phenomenal race. But so let's just call that one, even if we call that one a tie, then you take the Florida Derby versus the Jockey Club Gold Cup against the Olders.
Yep. Elders. That's key.
That's a no-brainer which one wins that competition.
I don't disagree. You're giving me permission to vote for Code of Honor. I appreciate that. But what about the whole finishing first in the Derby thing, America's most, you know, prestigious race?
Yeah, but he didn't win, right? He got disqualified.
And you and I both supported that decision. Maybe if we were more, oh, that was an unjust DQ, maybe we would feel differently at the end of the day, right? I mean, if you felt like that was unjust, do you think you would still be saying the same thing?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. I mean, he didn't win. I don't know. Maybe that's a big what if that could change it. But the good news is we don't have to play that game, right?
I know.
You were definitely disqualified. And
that was a mean question I asked you, but I've just never known you to be such a rule follower. So I'm fascinated by it.
Well, everyone accusing me of being a rule breaker. This is the second time, 24 hours.
A rule break? I just accused you of being a rule follower.
Oh, well, yeah, exactly. Well, you were surprised that I was being a rule follower because you've always known me to be a rule breaker.
That's exactly right. That's exactly fair. Oh, that's pretty funny. All right, we got completely thrown off our game here with that little aside, but I think it was an interesting one and something obviously we'll return to, but I'm sure listeners want to hear info from us that's going to help them, hopefully, when it comes to cashing tickets at the Breeders' Cup in just a few weeks. I mean, Vino Rosso was pretty darn awesome in the race anyway. At 7-2, he probably was the value of the race. Well, what sort of look are you thinking of giving him when it comes to the Classic? Where is he going to end up on your Classic rankings?
He's one of those horses that we had heard all summer that he was training well. We didn't get to see him run. In the second, in the Woodward up at Saratoga, and the same buzz. He was you know, big horse. He's a 4 year old, an older 4 year old. You know, he's been around. He's kind of seen a lot of races and seems to be maturing and going the right direction. It's Todd Pletcher. It's a horse who's forwardly placed. I think he could be dangerous out there as a horse that's, you know, 12 to 1, probably 15 to 1, that has a shot. I just don't think that he's a horse that I necessarily trust, but I wouldn't talk anyone off of him.
One more note about the DQ before I ask you about the unfun part of this. And you know where I'm going when I say that. People were saying, oh, what's the difference between this DQ and the inquiry that happened in race 5 on the day? And I just think it's such an insane point. Like, the incident in race 5 where the horse got shut off, to me, there's just no way in the world that affects the order of finish there, to the point where I almost thought it was frivolous for, I think it was Jose Ortiz, who actually claimed foul, which I was surprised by in and of itself, given the potential politics there. But he wasn't cost a placing. Like, if that happens and then another horse beats him, the horse that was fouled, for second, it opens it up. But you asked before, oh, does the margin matter? The margin matters absolutely the way these rules are written, because it helps you assess what cost a placing means. So if Vino Rosso re-rallies and wins by a length, there's no DQ in the Jockey Club Gold Cup. But when Code of Honor makes that margin a nose, that to me just proves that the getting knocked off stride for a second absolutely made the difference. In race 5, I mean, like I said, it was borderline frivolous to me to have an inquiry about the betting result. Now, should the stewards take a look at that and potentially assign days? Absolutely, they should look at it. And I don't know. I'm not going to weigh in on that. I didn't watch that one close enough, and I'm just sort of spitballing here. But to me, they can be two different conversations. But that's the other sort of funny thing about the Code of Honor Vino Rosso. You know, we talk about Category 1 all the time. This is a DQ in Category 1 to me. And I don't really see, I don't even fully grasp the other side of it. I considered trying to, I was hoping you would feel the other way just so somebody could educate me. But I'm sure we'll be having those conversations going forward. There'll be some angry listener who sends me 6 tweets about why I'm wrong. And I want to hear it, because I always enjoy checking out that perspective. Okay, going into the race, JK, you talked about how some part of you didn't want Tacitus to win, so you could bet him back at a big price in a race like the Breeders' Cup Classic. Do you still feel that way after this disappointing and dull third place finish?
I don't. Our relationship has ended.
You've given Tacitus the pink slip.
He has been removed from my life. Yeah. No, he just didn't. There's nothing about his performance that made me think, oh, okay, there's his excuse. He's going to run better because of this. He had like a perfect trip. He got everything he kind of really needed and wanted. He was forward, which I always thought he would be good in a forward type position, grinding away, and he was absolutely empty. He's run well on that racetrack before, so that's not an excuse. I don't even know if we'd see him there at this point. Do you?
It wouldn't feel that way. I mean, again, it would be one of these things where I'd just trust Bill Mott completely. If he saw something, or he had some reason to think and showed up and was a huge price. I'm not going to go as far as you and say that our relationship has ended. There are ways in which this horse might still end up being a betting vehicle, because this was, I mean, have you ever seen a worse third in a grade one?
Yeah, it was bad. I mean, I guess in the back of my head, my plan with him would be skip the Breeders' Cup, run in the Clark, give him the rest of the year off, come back as a four-year-old, and try out, start all over again. Yeah,
I might just pull the plug now and let him grow up and see if we can figure out whatever mentally isn't quite there. I mean, that's the way that Sean Clancy described it when we had him on after the Travers, is he saw this as a horse with immense talent for whom the penny had just not dropped. And he was just, for lack of a better word, goofy and not mind on business to the degree that a horse like his rival Code of Honor shows. And with that in mind, months to just grow up and be a horse and then come back and see if he maybe gets it next year. We've seen these kind of breaks really benefit horses. I remember, you know, Honor Code being a horse that people thought was maybe going to be an underachiever and taking a break and coming back and I mean, honestly, even with Code of Honor himself, so hard talking about those two horses in the same conversation. I'm worried I'm going to get the names wrong, but I think I've got it right. Even just the little break he took before he came back in the Dwyer, it seemed like they went away boys and came back men. And I think that's the kind of transition we're going to need to see from Tacitus if he's ever going to fulfill the potential we saw in him. And then, and I'm willing to acknowledge this, it's also possible, I hate to say this because I really don't believe it's true, but I think we have to face up to the fact that it might just be we've been making excuses for a horse who's just not anywhere near as good as we thought he was. Where do you stand on that last issue?
Yeah, it's shocking because there were so many performances that were so good that, you know, maybe it's a little bit of a knee-jerk reaction to just dismiss him totally. But for whatever reason, I was just so disappointed by his last race. He just ran – the way he ran the Jockey Club Gold Cup, he had no excuse. He just didn't fire. Just didn't fire, didn't run by horses, looked like he was going to, and did absolutely nothing.
Let's move on, JK. Let's go to Midnight Bisou, who you talked about, figured was going to win the Beldame, did win the Beldame, and you were then looking forward to trying to oppose at a future date, comes back with a 91 buyer speed figure. Do you feel exactly the same? Are we all set up now to maybe take Midnight Bisou on next time?
Yes, now I am ready for that. I am ready to beat her. She ran well. She looked like she was in trouble, and then she just kicked away. But I think she's primed and ready for beating come Breeders' Cup Saturday when she shows up in the distaff. Depending on who shows up against her, I'd imagine a late. But you know the way that things happened this weekend with McKenzie, if I was at Claiborne Farm, I'd be considering an Adele Dill Schneider. I'd be considering a late for the classic.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I feel like the openness of this. We talked about the creative possibility of Bricks and Mortar. Neither of us really sees that. I don't even know. You wonder if Coolmore doesn't look and take a shot with running something, one of the turf horses, in this year's classic. That also might make sense. We've seen the shippers from afar outrun their odds before out at Santa Anita in the classic on dirt, and to that end as well, you wonder about that for a late. So let's just envision a world where we think a late is going to go to the classic, which is no information or anything, it's just speculation. Do you have somebody in mind to take Midnight Bisou down, or would you just be looking at it as a big spread race, almost where your opinion in the distaff is anybody but Midnight Bisou?
I'm not 100% sure. I mean, obviously a late would be the one that I feel the most comfortable with, but part of me wants to see a late show up in the classic. So if a late doesn't show up there, I mean, I guess maybe like a horse like Street Band seems to be going the right direction. Dunbar Road, obviously we haven't seen her second race yet. Not her second race. We haven't seen her race since the Alabama. So I'm excited to see her run again. She was looking like she was going to be a quality animal. Guarana kind of disappointed a little bit last time. We'll see what happens with her. It's going to be interesting. There's not a deepest group, but there is some that I think that could be dangerous to go against Midnight Bisou.
Let's talk about the Grade 1 Vosburgh Imperial Hint. 103 buyer speed figure. Really interesting race in terms of tactics. And I'm a big Javier Castellano fan, and I'm glad he was able to come back and win by that nose, because I think they would have been out for him if he had lost there, because it seemed like he was consciously maybe trying to save a little, thinking that he had plenty and was going to win. And what would look to me like a very canny ride by Arad Ortiz it seemed like he almost surprised Javier arriving on the scene when he did, and he really had to work tooth and nail to get it done at 1-4 in the Vosburgh. What did you think of this race? What do you think about Imperial Hint and Forensic Fire going forward to the Breeders' Cup Sprint this year?
I think the ride on Forensic Fire was smart. That was the only way they were going to win. Stick it to him. And that's what they did, and they almost got the job done, but Imperial Hemp was game. He's a game little horse. I'd imagine that probably took a little bit out of him, though. As a small horse, you know, I don't know a lot about the physicality of the equine athletes, but you do know that the smaller ones When keeping weight on them, I think is probably something that's tough. And I would imagine that a knockdown, drag down, drag out fight like they had in the lane there at Belmont, it's going to take a little out of him. Now he's got 5 weeks to kind of get it back in order, but that's the kind of performance that would make me kind of lean towards Chance a lot. Hopefully he runs well next weekend at Santa Anita, or Matoli, who is one of my favorite sprinters and one of my favorite horses in training.
And a horse like McKenzie that you've been on the record for many months declaring was going to win a Breeders' Cup race, Matoli. So I imagine you have a little bit of a lean in that regard as well. That's such a great question, and it's one of these things that's soft and it's very hard to assess. But I think you could find equally sharp people, some who'd argue what you said, JK, and I tend to agree with you that I'm not sure that was – I think they would have rather prepped there by just cruising in easy. I mean, this is a horse who has sometimes not always put the races back to back. I think there are other people who'd say, oh, he'll get so much out of that. It was because it was a tough fight. I don't know. I mean, for me, these battle-tested sprinters, I'm more inclined to look at the world your way in all regards. But, I mean, this horse has stuck it to me before, Imperial Hint, and I'm going to give him every consideration when it comes to putting together tickets for this year's Breeders' Cup. If there are iterations that don't cost too much money to include him, I would like to do that, but he's not going to be where I'm looking to lean, that's for sure. Let's talk about some of the other stuff that happened at Belmont. Let's go to Structor, who surprised both of us in that neither of us picked him, and gets the job done with an 80 buyer speed figure against our selections, who were Our Country and No Word, I believe. Is this Structor going to go to the Breeders' Cup as a favorite, and is he going to be tough to beat once again?
No, I think he'll probably go to the Breeders' Cup as a favorite, but not one that I'll be leaning on. I just wasn't overly impressed with his performance. He's not the kind of Chad Brown that you want to lean on. There's a lot of Chads you can lean on. To me, Structure is just kind of a workman type, nothing too flashy. The figures aren't too quick. Our Country just can't get a good trip, and it's unfortunate because I think he's sitting on a big race, so I hope we can see him out there at a big price, because I think he's a talented horse that just has been unlucky in his last two races. So No Word didn't really have an excuse. I thought No Word got a pretty good trip, ended up kind of getting wide. Johnny had to try to bowl himself out of there and kind of bumped into Our Country at the top of the stretch, and Our Country went on and No Word didn't. So, Structor ran well, but I can't imagine being just over the moon with him and feeling like there's no other shot. We'll see who shows up next week at Keeneland. But that could obviously lead to who I would end up playing in this spot.
Doesn't sound like you're over Our Country, though. You think there might be a chance that he could rebound in a race like the Juvenile Turf?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You know, especially with some nice firm ground that he'll get. You know, that might be something that he likes. Maybe he doesn't like it. But kind of a change of scenery, and they've learned, you know, Manny's learned more about him in his last two races to figure out possible ways to avoid the trouble. George Weaver obviously can make some adjustments to kind of help get him to relax a little bit and to find a better trip. And if he finds a better trip, I think he could be dangerous.
Let's pull this back to California and talk about some more of the stuff that went on Saturday night. Mirth gets the job done in the Rodeo Drive, a grade one with a 94 buyer speed figure. I think the next time Mirth appears in the afternoons, I'm going to say, hey, last time was the time. What did you think of this race?
I thought that Mike Smith was brilliant. You put him to sleep on the front end, going a mile and a quarter down from the inside. And it just kicked away. I thought he did a remarkable job with this horse. I think Beau Recall was probably a little bit too far back, but and maybe with a little bit closer ride could have been dangerous. I think Beau Recall is one that you could look at in the Philly and Mare Turf. If she shows up, she could be dangerous in there. But like you said, I agree. I think last time was a time with Mirth. I think that when she gets loose, if she gets loose in the Breeders' Cup, they'll come for her a little bit sooner, knowing that she's got the ability to stay on. With the win over the surface, win at a mile and a quarter. I agree. Last time was the time, but good for Billy Koch and the guys at Little Red Feather.
Absolutely. Very cool to see those colors in the winner's circle. And isn't that an instance maybe where the price on the board, who other riders think the contenders are, plays into how the race is ridden. And then next time when the horse, even though the horse will be a big price, just seeing, oh, they just want a grade one wire to wire, probably got to stay a little bit closer to this one, afford this one a little bit more respect.
Absolutely. And then they get challenged at the 3/8 pole rather than getting challenged at the 3/16 when it's too late. So I completely agree with that.
All right. What else do you want to talk about, JK? We could move on to some Sunday stuff. I'm not sure if you were paying attention to any of the Churchill, some races that might have Breeders' Cup Dirt Mile implications. The ACAC, Mr. Freeze wins with a 100 figure, and the Lucas Classic goes to Mosito Rojo with a 97. I mean, I think we're going to have to look at those races and figure out who all's going to show up in the Dirt Mile. Feels to me like the discussion of the Dirt Mile, from my point of view, we're going to know a lot more when we see what happens with Omaha Beach. You've thoroughly convinced me that that's going to be the target for Omaha Beach after competing in the sprint next weekend. Any thoughts on anything coming out of Churchill?
I think that Mosito Rojo has to go down as a pretty impressive claim. It was claimed for $10,000, and has rattled off quite a bit of money, quite a bit of wins. And I think it's always cool to see horses like that to get claimed and go on to be stakes type. So good for Mosito Rojo and the connections for claiming that one.
All right, let's talk about Sunday's action. We had plenty of stuff going on. A horse we've talked about plenty, who I know a lot of folks were very eager to bet back out of the Travers, including Mike Maloney. Owendale, 2-1. Winning the Oklahoma Derby on a card where Steve Asmussen just dominated, but Brad Cox and Rupp Racing get it done here with Owendale. What did you think of this one?
I thought he was impressive. I thought that he was also he helped kind of prove what we all knew, that the inside wasn't where you wanted to be a majority at Saratoga, where Owendale spent a lot of time in the Travers. He was down on the inside. And I think that probably influenced his fifth place finish in that race. And then he came back and ran big in the Oklahoma Derby. So I'd imagine we'll see him somewhere. It'd be cool for him to show up as a price type horse in a race like the Classic. I don't know if he could get into that race off of the Oklahoma Derby win, but there's a possibility always.
Would you give him a chance as potentially a 3-year-old still going forward? He's going to be well behind the best of them on speed figures.
I don't give him a chance to win the race. I give him a chance to get a piece to, you know, he's the kind of horse I could see they take him back, make one run. He could get third when it all falls apart. I don't think the distance is going to be a problem for him. And he's a horse that I think could really turn into something at four if they can keep him in the training and keep him going and keep him progressing. I think Brad Cox could have a good horse, good four-year-old on his hands for next year.
We don't have figures from Sunday for Santa Anita, but Paradise Woods gets the job done in the grade two Zenyatta. I mean, is she one who could finally be fulfilling the potential in a way where she could make noise on a Breeders' Cup stage?
You know, she's a curious horse for me just because, you know, I've obviously have had my my affairs with her where I loved her and thought she was going to run really well and she didn't. And then she's been kind of odd and been in, been out, been good, been bad. And it seems like John Sheriffs has her going in the right direction. I just don't think she's as good as these other horses. I don't think she's as good as a horse like Midnight Bisou or a Late or Dunbar Road even. So, you know, she'll have the home court advantage if she shows up in that spot, which I'd imagine she would. But there's nothing about that performance. Obviously you got to see what the figure looks like, but there's nothing about that performance visually that made me feel like, oh, this is who I'm betting in the Classic.
Chad Brown gets it done once again in the Miss Grillo selflessly at 5-1, and she'll go on to the race that Chad Brown's really fairly well dominated in the last decade, the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Fillies Turf. She was actually a pretty square 5-1 with the presence of Cristal, who made a run from far back and ran pretty well, all things considered, I thought, going down just 3/4 of a length. When it comes to the Juvenile Fillies Turf, JK, who would you prefer between Selflessly and Cristal next time?
Yeah, I think still Cristal. You know, I think that she's one that, you know, that might not have been necessarily the spot for her. she's going to get in no matter what off of that win at Saratoga. She's going to get into the Breeders' Cup. She didn't necessarily need the Miss Grillo to get in. So I think she'll be able to get in that spot. I think maybe John Kimmel might have taken a little bit easy on her leading into this race. I don't know that for sure. Just speculation. But I think she's one that you could definitely look at. Selflessly is just one of those Chad Brown horses, 5-1 on the board. She just doesn't wow you, and you know how Chad's going to be betting that race, and opportunities to beat him with horses that don't necessarily wow you, I think are great opportunities from a wagering standpoint.
Yeah, Cristal had a trip. Sparkling Sky had a trip as well in there. Any of the others you feel like talking about or calling out you could see maybe being on your tickets? Or, you know, obviously we're going to have time to dive into this a lot deeper, but just off the top of your head, anything else to take away from the Miss Grillo?
No, I think Cristal and Sparkling Sky are the ones that I would want moving forward. Obviously, a little lower on the totem pole in terms of connection fame. Not necessarily Todd, but John Kimmel for sure. So I think some better opportunities when you show up and for Breeders' Cup.
Now, we have a whole other show dedicated to just handicapping and handicapping principles. And this race, I'm just going to throw at you. We talked about it for a second before. The fifth race from Saturday. We were not at our best in this one, JK, talking with such confidence about the horses that we liked, neither of whom ran well. And, you know, I'm somebody who I pride myself on trying to be able to read the tote board, and I get very embarrassed when I miss one as badly as I missed Princessa Caroline, who had all this pedigree, the half to Lady Eli, and just gets the job done. I mean, couldn't have been deader on the board and just put the lie to the idea that that even matters, at least in this instance, by winning pretty easily. And then there were three horses coming out of the same race. We tipped two of them. The third one runs better than either of ours. I was just curious what you thought about that and basically to analyze the horrendous job we did in handicapping Saturday's fifth race.
Well, look, I'm not even that embarrassed, really. I mean, she was 9-2, Princessa Caroline. So if she was 9-2, she's a Chad Brown, half the Lady Eli by American Pharoah with Javier, and she's 9-2, like no one thought she was going to run well. So when she wins like she did, you know, obviously I think she, you know, caught a lot of people off guard. Reminds me a little bit of Analyze It. If you remember,
yep.
He was 10-1, the other Chad in the race, and he ran off the screen. I didn't feel stupid about that day either when I didn't have Analyze It. So she ran well, and it's exciting when we get to see these horses with good pedigree that are related to other horses that we loved when they were on the racetrack. So should be a lot of fun to see her continue on in her career, and good for her to get the job done. But her winning does not put a dent in my handicapping ego.
I think other people will look at this and say, oh my gosh, that was so clearly value. After the race, it's hard to argue with somebody who says that. Before the race, you and I think, wait a second, if they thought this filly could run, there'd be money showing up for her. How do you reconcile that? The idea of there being signal in the money, in particularly in maiden races and with layoff horses, versus the general concept of value?
Well, with the power of technology and radio, Pete, I sure wish you could look that stat up and tell me what it is with Chad Brown and how he does with horses that are over 4-1 and races that he's debuting these horses.
It's funny that you should say that, JK, because thanks to the miracle of Stats Racelens, we can look up that stat exactly. And it is so much better than either you or I guessed it would be. How about this? Debuting on turf, so just first-time starters of any age debuting on turf in the past 5 years. Chad Brown, 24 of 160, so that's 15% lower than his baseline. 37% in the money, lower than his baseline. But the ROI, JK, $2.53, a potentially profitable angle. And I think it might just go to the idea. We talk about it a lot. The quote comes from the great screenwriter William Goldman, talking about Hollywood and people who think they can predict what's going to happen, but they really can't. Nobody knows nothing. We hear all this info. We know that in many instances, there is signal in the tote board, but not not in this instance, not with Chad Brown, with these first-time starters. It's something I'm going to consider. Maybe the only way I'll use this actionably is in a spread race. I think it's just going to make me more inclined, honestly, to use every Chad Brown. If there are three and two have buzz and one doesn't, I might still use the one that doesn't have buzz because nobody knows nothing. Now, let's turn it back to the horses that you and I liked in this race, and those were Boxer Rebellion, the other Chad Brown, and then Our Little Jewel, a horse who impressed me very much physically in Saratoga. The start of this race was an absolute mess, bumper cars even. For some reason, I don't want to forgive Boxer Rebellion as much as I want to forgive Our Little Jewel. And maybe that just is down to, I feel like when you hear about a Chad Brown horse who has a perfect trip first out and doesn't run, and we know he brings them to the races fully formed, maybe that's a horse you're supposed to just fade. And Our Little Jewel, I have ingrained in my mind that picture of her walking by. And I want to give her one more chance. And I also think she'll be a considerably bigger price, potentially. How do you look at the two horses we picked in this race going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I hate to agree with you completely, but, like, I do. I mean, I like the Chad horse is supposed to be a freak. Didn't show that the first time. Gave the horse another chance to show that it was a freak. Didn't show it the second time. It's another horse that I'll be ending my relationship with.
JK, breaking hearts left and right here. Let me point out a difference between a bet horse that we've heard tipped out that doesn't run well, that we want back, and that we don't want back. You can probably guess what I'm going to say, but I'll go ahead and say it anyway. It has to do with what they're doing next out, right? So a horse that we've heard tipped, you know, the best horse in Mark Cassie's barn or Kieran McLaughlin's barn, and they go racing an inadequate 6 furlongs at Saratoga, and then they come back running longer. Those are horses I'll forgive. A horse that has a trip excuse, one that was bet and doesn't break, will come back very often and then break the next time and run well. I just want an excuse or them doing something different. I think there's probably a lot more equity with a horse like Boxer Rebellion. And this is just red boarding after the fact, but my head is in this space now helping Spencer with his show. It's a good example of a horse you want to fade, I think, when we look at it after, because I didn't see a trip excuse and the horse was doing the exact same thing. If you had it back, do you buy that argument, or were you still happy with sticking with Boxer Rebellion there?
No, if I had it back, that, you know, I mean, obviously hindsight is 20/20 when you learn that lesson, because she did nothing, in the second running. She didn't really do anything in the first running either. I was just trying to give her blind allegiance and say that there was something, you know, there's so many things behind the scene we don't know about. Maybe she hated the bit in her mouth. Maybe she stepped on a rock on the way over. I don't know. There's a million things that can go wrong that can keep a horse from running to their potential. I was just trying to give her a second chance. But yeah, I'd take that second chance back now if I could.
And you're saying that, I mean, obviously, once you know the result, I was saying just in terms of decision process, is it something to consider that maybe these tipped out horses with no trip excuse, maybe that you use the tip in reverse, it becomes the opposite, that maybe the horse is more of a morning glory, impressing people to be tipped out, but when they don't run in the afternoon, more equity going against everything else being equal. Anyway, that's my theory, and I'm going to stick with it for a little while. We're running out of time, JK. Anything else racing-wise from the weekend you want to bring up? Anybody you've been fighting with on Twitter you need to explain in more than 180 characters or whatever it is?
No, I've been behaving on Twitter. Oh, I guess we probably should give a little bit of love to Eight Rings, who's going to be the juvenile favorite.
Oh, I forgot about Friday's races. Oops, host fail. Let's leave it in. It's funny. Let's talk about those races for a minute. Yeah, what did you think of Eight Rings?
Oh, I mean, I think Eight Rings was magnificent. I think that we, you know, he had the huge race on debut. He was known to be Baffert's best 2-year-old, especially in that group of SF West that they kind of put together, SF Racing with Tom Ryan and Saul and Jack Wolf and Starlight and a couple of other partners that put together some money, and Donato Lani bought all those good horses, and I think this is the best one of all of them. And the whole point was to make a stallion, and it seems like they're barking up that tree with this horse, and I think he'll be favored. Just because it's Baffert and it's California, I think Dennis's moment will be right there in a close second. And history has a way of repeating itself, right? So, Eight Rings, Classic Empire, very similar. They ran in and one turn grade ones, lost the rider in both of their grade, their one turn grade ones. They come back, win two turn grade twos or grade ones, two turn grade ones, and then they go on to be the favorite for the Classic, and then they beat a Dale Roman's horse. not this time with Classic Empire, Dennis's moment, this year with Dale Roman's. History could repeat itself.
Eight Rings will be behind from a speed figure point of view, so it will be interesting to see how that plays out. Eight Rings earned an 87 on Friday night at Santa Anita, but was imperious in victory. You know what, that's a polite way of saying, winning by six. Johnny Velasquez is going to keep them out. And I hear a rumor, JK, that Johnny Velasquez may be a guest on our late week show, courtesy of our new correspondent, Naomi Tucker. Very interested to hear what he has to say, because not only did he get the spoils with Eight Rings on Friday night, he also got the job done with Bast, who earned an 81 buyer speed figure, and she will go on to be one of the favorites, I would think. She was 1-5, and she barely got it done against Comical. Makes me, and probably everybody else, a lot less confident in her abilities than in the Three Rings camp. But what did you think of Bast and that group as a whole?
Yeah, she didn't really, you know, she didn't really move me with that performance. I mean, she ran well enough. I don't want to knock her for it. She got the job done, winning a grade one and stretching out, and so. But there's nothing about that performance that said I'm going to, you know, cut in line to single her in the pick four on Friday for Future Star Friday.
Future Star Friday, indeed. Let's talk about another Friday, Keeneland opening. We've got so much great stuff happening on the site, in podcast form, and even at Keeneland. I will be arriving at Keeneland on Friday, probably posting up in the green room for much of that day. Looks like we're going to put a fun crew together for dinner Friday night. I'm really excited to get back there. Then Saturday, this is one where we want to see some listeners turn up. We're going to be having our own tailgate up on the hill. We're going to start before the races. We'll probably end up hanging there for a good portion of the day. But if you're somebody who's got your spot inside, come early and have hopefully a Bloody Mary and a beer with us up on the hill. We'll give more details about exactly where we're going to be, but plan on it, I'd say, from about 11, 11:15. No formal program. We'll just be hanging out, talking to people. Lots of special content on the blog, as I mentioned. John Camardo has been busily crunching numbers. I sent out the first piece about jockeys and trainers. He's looking at stats specific to the fall meet, which I love. I think that's an extra step that some stats people don't necessarily do when looking at Keeneland numbers. He's looking at the fall meet specifically. Hopefully, we'll find some stuff to learn, and hopefully, I'll tag the right John Camardo when I send the post around and give it a boost a little bit later today. John's going to have a few pieces throughout the week. We're going to have a special podcast for Keeneland opening day. I'm hoping you'll be a part of that, JK.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, anytime I need to get anytime I can escape a green coat, it always makes me happy. It's my exciting moments of the fall and the spring, is escaping the green coat.
Oh, there'll be some good green coat videos, I have a feeling, emerging from our time up on the hill. We'll have to figure out what all the rules up there are, just so we can break one or two to get somebody in a green coat scolding us. I know it's part of the Keeneland experience that we enjoy. But it's just going to be so much fun to be back there. I swore after the Breeders' Cup in 15 that I wouldn't miss a Keeneland meet. Truth be told, I did have some travel woes and did miss Keeneland fall last year. But I feel like I got that itch scratched with the amazing Breeders' Cup experience. But I've been to all the rest and looking forward to this. So we'll be doing shows for Fridays at Keeneland, shows for Sundays at Keeneland. A lot of those will be short, just 20 minutes running down the card. We're going to incorporate extra Keeneland coverage into our Saturday shows as well. Look for all that stuff on the network. Look for lots of extra blog content from John Camardo on InTheMoneyPodcast.com. I'm sure Spencer Lugenbuehl will be doing plenty of Keeneland red boarding. Sounds like he's got a special guest lined up to help us all get ready for the Keeneland meet this week with Mike Maloney. So a lot of cool stuff is going to be happening, and hopefully we get a chance to hang out with some listeners in person as well. Any other closing thoughts from you, JK, before we kick this episode of the In the Money Players podcast?
No, that's it. I'm looking forward to Keeneland. It's going to be fun.
hopefully we'll have some other fun guests on those Keeneland shows as well. I'm sure Sean Borman will make his return to the In the Money airwaves. Jack Jenkins did such a good job. You know, Spencer would be fun to have on there. Hey, and if you're out there in the listenership, feel free to send us recommendations of people you want to hear. When we have the extra content, especially, it's easy to bring in some missed voices, some new voices, etc. All right. That's going to do it for this edition of the In the Money Players Podcast. I thank you very much, JK. We'll thank our sponsors, Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation. Boy, that looked like a fun event out there with Kendrick Carmouche Saturday night. I was cooking for a friend's 50th birthday. I didn't have the chance to get out there when it moved from Sunday to Saturday, but the pictures sure look like fun. Of course, you can give to them at any time through our link, trfinc.org/players. We'll thank our friends at 10 Strike Racing. What a year they've had, winner after winner. Black Type Thoroughbreds. We had Jake as a guest on the breeding show last week. He did such a good job. We're going to be bothering him again soon. He'd be a great one for one of the Keeneland shows as well. Hopefully we'll get him in there. Stats Racelands, Woodbine, Monmouth, everybody who's made this year so successful for us in our maiden voyage, 80 shows in on the flagship station. Pretty cool stuff. And as I always do, got to thank all of you, the listeners, for making it happen, for giving us the support, for supporting our partners. You're the best, and we hope to continue to get feedback from you. We want to open up some more lanes for people to ask questions and maybe even get involved helping out if you're interested in doing a little bit more for this little horse racing community that we've created. I'll be doing a blog post about that possibility this week as well. It's been sitting in my drafts forever. It's time for me to get off my duff and get that going. This show's been a production of In the Money Media. In the Money Media's business manager is Drew Cotney. Our chief creative officer is Jonathan Kinchin. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital. May you win all your photos!